direct from the edge of the lunatic fringe, it's the Raleigh James Show.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. We have 3 hours to spend together tonight, and I was just wondering, what on earth am I going to talk about? And as I was rolling around in my mind, I realized, oh, wait a minute. He's going to save me. We have Steve Probst on tonight. So, Steve, without further ado, welcome to WGN Radio. How are you?
Well, thank you. I didn't know I'd been assigned a saving role, but I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, I forgot all about this, and literally I was sitting here thinking, what? And then all of a sudden it crossed my mind. I thought, oh, this is too good to be true. So I'm delighted about that. And so yes, as always, plenty of wonderful things to talk about. But I was just, would have been of all things Donnie Elbert's 89th birthday this week, and I was just going over some of my notes about him. And if he wasn't the most unlucky person, I mean, this guy wrote more than anybody, and half the stuff he wrote that became hits was stolen from him. And I thought, he's not alone. So I figured we'd start there. Of course, we know poor Kent Harris and shopping for clothes. But in terms of that, tell me some of the big ones in your mind, records that were woulda, coulda, shoulda, and then they came out by somebody else.
Well, Have I Sinned was a killer, but I'll tell you something. This is a sword that, two-edged sword, to coin a phrase.
Okay.
Because Donnie took the recitation part of My Confession of Love from Edna McGriff's Heavenly Angel.
Oh, no. Okay.
Oh, no. So he was up to speed as far as purloining lines. He had it done to him. But he was, capable of being a songwriter with a lot of influences. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, and that's well put. I would think, though, song for song, probably he was done wrong more than he did wrong, just because it happened so many times. But while I was reviewing some notes, I didn't realize that, his first group, the Vibraharps, that Danny Cannon, who was in it, became Lenny O'Henry with Across the Street.
Wow. Okay, that's a new one on me. But what songs were you thinking about Donnie Elbert that he had inspired other songs?
Well,
to be,
Shame, 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 and that
okay.
was interesting. He claims he wrote it, not only inspired, but he claims he actually wrote it. And then when it came out, of course, Sylvia Robinson was credited. But the big one, and I'm sure you've heard this story, and God, he was nothing if not good for lots of stories, would be Daryl Banks and Open the Door to Your Heart.
Wow. Now, connect the two. What song, what Donnie Elbert song are we talking about?
Well, Donnie Elbert wrote Open the Door to Your Heart.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
And he actually, he lived long enough to see the royalties on that.
So was there a court action, or did he just have an amicable agreement?
I don't think it was too amicable. I don't think it actually went to trial, but there was a lot of noise and a lot of threats.
Now, songs that have, I'm sort of up to speed on other songs that have shown up in hit records like... Please, Mr. Postman showed up in Mashed Potato Time.
Yes.
You know about that. How about Quarter to Three showing up in Runaround Sue?
Right. Now, was anything, and of course, God knows Frank Guida would have taken action, but did he?
I don't know. But Gary U.S. Bond sure sang about it.
Yep, absolutely.
Copycat.
Yeah. Oh, man.
He told me that there was a street gang in Norfolk that he was, God, I forget the name of the street gang. I've written down in my interview that he was going to go look up Dion and see what if he could settle at the...
Oh, that would have been interesting.
The extra legal way, let's say. But I don't think that ever happened. But here's Gary U.S. Bonds. Both Dion and Gary U.S. Bonds are still around, still going strong. That's great stuff right there.
And that's amazing, especially with Dion, considering his checkered past and his drug use. I mean, for him to make it this long, that's a testament to good genes, I guess.
Yeah, I would think. Good luck.
Now, I was sitting here trying
which they
to
all can use.
Sitting here trying to think, and you probably do know this, but do you remember "Sad Feeling" by Cicero Blake?
No.
Okay, then you probably won't know this, but Leo Austell, who had a couple record labels, wound up using the exact same track on another record. And I was trying to think of what the hell was that other record, but you won't be able to answer that then.
What label was she on?
I'm trying to think of what they put Cicero Blake on, but let me let you hear a little of it.
Oh,
because
Cicero Blake?
Yeah, sad feeling here, and it's the exact same intro.
That was on Success, wasn't it?
You know, I don't know. Let me. It was released several times, so let's find out.
One of the great labels out of Iowa.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Exactly. But no, I know whatever it was, it ultimately was a Leo Austell label. Let me see what. But there's another, and I should have thought about this beforehand. But then again, I forgot everything. But I think it was on Renee originally. And Leo Austell produced it. But then on one of his other labels, I don't think it was, I don't know what it was, but there was the exact same backing track. And while we're talking, maybe it'll come to me. But I thought Sad Feeling was a great song, by the way. So indeed. All right.
Okay.
So with that in mind, maybe we've exhausted this. But
do you think we can get more obscure? I'm not sure.
Exactly.
That's possible.
Well, I loved Ron Dante's quote about the music business when he said, "There's an old saying: the music business is full of crooks and thieves and people who'd stab their mothers for a dollar." And then there's the downside. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I can relate.
And I think there's a certain amount of truth to that also.
I was never part of it. I just study it from a safe distance, so I won't be get too infected with the motivation or the results. I just stand there and cluck at it and... hope for the best.
Well, and I've written numerous books about it, and your what was the first rock and roll record continues to live on, because I can't tell you how often I'll have somebody call and say, "Well, I know the record that was the first rock and roll record." No, you don't.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, you don't. And
compile a list of their candidates. Maybe that can be volume two.
Right, exactly. But what's interesting about it, of course, is everybody wants to be able to put it in a nice box, wrap a bow around it, and say, this is when it started. Like last night, I was talking to a caller, Isaac, and he asked me if the Carter family actually started modern country music. And apparently it had something to do with somebody mentioned something on the ACM Awards. But, you know, I hated to break it to him, but there's no one line of demarcation when anything started. And your book is so wonderful about that, because you've got about 50 good choices in there.
Yeah, well, we tried, and certainly, that was an arbitrary limitation. I think that there's always room for more candidates, but I'm pretty happy with the results. I mean, it was, everything from country and western to your favorite, Les Paul and Mary Ford. That's the one you would have nixed and put in.
I probably would have, but there again, all of it. That's the interesting thing about those songs, because all of them had a hand in shaping what would become quote unquote rock and roll. So that's why they're all worthy candidates. But to single anyone out, I always go with G by the Crows only because it got so much pop airplay. But all of them were worthy.
Yeah, well, you also like it because there's a Huggy Boy story attached to it.
Well, and
is Huggy Boy, you can't go wrong.
That's absolutely true. That's so true. You know, talk about a guy who never got his just desserts in any real way. And it's a real real shame. But anytime I think of Huggy Boy, and I think we've discussed this, I will always laugh about his court appearance when he actually said to the judge, I didn't know I was supposed to give the government a cut about not paying his taxes. And
I'd never heard that.
Oh, yeah. No, this was when, if you remember, he got into big IRS trouble because of all those record hops, and he never, ever reported any of that money.
Right.
And so, sure enough, he comes to court and just completely straight-faced because he meant it to the bottom of his heart when he said, but, Your Honor, I didn't know I was supposed to give the government a cut. And,
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, and sadly, that tells us why everybody remembered Art LeBeau and knew that name, because he was nothing if not a businessman, and poor Huggy Boy, you know, couldn't keep two dimes in his pocket, but I always contended between the two of them, he was the real deal.
Yeah, well, Art, you know, I mean, we can discuss the proclivities and habits of each one. I mean,
oh, yeah.
if Huggy Boy hadn't spent so much time at the track, you know, if.
Well, right, right. Oh, everything about him was nuts. And that's in no way to cast aspersions about Art. Thank God for him, because his business sense caused him to come up with everything from coining oldies but goodies to the clubs to the record labels to everything else. That was truly great. But, I mean, I never got, and I liked Art. Don't get me wrong. I still proudly wear my oldies but goodies jacket. But I got to say, if I had to guess between the two of them, which one of them really knew and loved the music, I wasn't going with Art. I mean,
now Art told me the story about how he came up with the oldies but goodies concept.
Really?
I don't know.
No,
yeah.
I don't know. Tell me.
Okay. Well, here he is with his both. Actually, he said Huggy Boy was involved in this. They were at one of their apartments, and they were playing records and trying to seduce whatever girlfriend was at hand, and getting up to change the record each time the song was over got to be daunting and interfered with their goal. So Art literally decided, okay, if I put sweet sounds on one side, you know, in the Still of the Night or things, he wasn't thinking about particular records, though. If I put love songs on one side and rock and roll songs on the other side, that might take care of my own personal problem. I can play 20 minutes of an LP and have plenty of time to mess around. So he actually took the idea to some major labels, Columbia, RCA, you know the
sure,
the lineup, and they each turned him down and said, you got to be joking, and you know, we're not going to have any part of this, even though he helped promote Elvis and Elvis was on RCA, et cetera, et cetera. So Art contacted Dootsie Williams, and Dootsie said, Art, you helped me break Earth Angel. You made my career for me, so you can use Earth Angel, but just don't put every Penguin's record on your LP. Just limit it to Earth Angel. Well, that broke the ice. Then other indie labels decided to join the party, and he was able, you know, Flash Records and Aladdin or whatever labels he contacted, particularly L.A. Indies, and he got his LP together. So it was Dootsie Williams that broke the ice for him and gave him the entree into figuring out what kind of music to put on his LPs.
That's interesting. When you said he went to Columbia, I could just hear Mitch Miller laughing him out of the room. But you know what's interesting is that literally, I'd say, just a couple of breaths away from that was Moish Levy with the series on Roulette. So
sure, Golden Goodies. Golden,
yeah, all of that, and then 22 original winners and everything else, and then Mercury did a bunch as well. But I think the Moish Levy stuff was probably literally within a month or two of Art.
Yeah, well, sure, but Art was the pioneer in that field.
Absolutely. You betcha.
And the thing that sort of frustrated me was every time he reissued the album, he changed the track. So volume one,
right.
The original volume one, had nothing to do with the
right.
Much later version.
Right. And then you get to the CDs. Don't even start me. All right, so we're talking to Steve Probst, which is always a delight, kind of making my night. And, of course, all that I don't know, he does know. So when you call and ask me questions and I don't know, he's the guy to ask. So 888-876-5593 on WGN Radio. WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James. Well, there he is. That's Cicero Blake, 1964, on Renee. By the way, we're talking with Steve Probst, and we will continue to do that right after the news. And maybe he can shed some light on it, because before the news, so, okay, this comes out in 1964 on Renee, and that's one of Leo Austell's labels. And then, and as far as writer's credit on that, it's actually said it's written by Barrett Strong. I don't know, but here's the deal. Moments later, okay, 2 years, comes this. Credited to Kenneth Griffin on the writing, but if that's not the same backing track, I mean, I think they just pulled the vocals off one and put it on another. But I'm sure there's other examples of that, and we'll continue to find fine stories as we talk to Steve Probst, and we'll get right back to it on WGN Radio. WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James. Of course, those are the Penguins, and that is the A-side. Yes, Earth Angel was, of course, the B-side, and Steve Probst, who we're talking with, knows all about that. That's for darn sure. Wasn't it Huggy Boy who caused that to flip?
Yeah, I think actually he did, just like Tony Allen told me that they misprinted Night Owl. They early 78s had the wrong title on the wrong side, and that's how Night Owl got played, because I was supposed to be the featured side. So
really?
You never can tell what's going to happen with a B-side. It might become historic and classic. I was also thinking about the Oldies But Goodies album. Let's say Mitch Miller had consented to use a track. Do you think Oldies But Goodies would be the same if Art was forced to put Yellow Rose of Texas
no.
on there?
Oh, I know. Absolutely.
How would he follow that?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that, you know, should that have come to pass, they would have come up with a doo-wop version of it somehow.
Yeah. it really lends itself to that that sound. You were talking about reusing tracks.
Yes.
Now, the pioneer in that endeavor, as far as I can determine, was a name you know well, George Mottola.
Okay.
He never created a track. He didn't love to use over and over again. A lot of them were put behind his erstwhile spouse, Ricky Page, who I think is still around and still singing in the Nashville area, but doing country and western. But he tried to promote her as the girl group sound, and it never quite worked, but he sure put out a ton of records by her, oftentimes using tracks that were behind Jesse Belvin or some of the other singers that he successfully promoted.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Mottola was interesting. Now, I always thought that Jesse Belvin wrote Goodnight, My Love, but apparently it's George Mottola who has the copyright. Well, his heirs, I guess, but I did not realize that. But
what happened was Jesse came to, I think he came to Huggy Boy and said, "I'll, you know, give me, I need $400 or $800 or whatever." And Huggy didn't have it, but Mottola walked in, or John Mariscalco, one of the two,
right,
maybe both of them, and they had the money and got the copyright.
Oh, geez. And that was so Jesse Belvin. He absolutely had no idea. He was holding on to gold, and he would, you know, sell songs for next to nothing. Really, really sad as far as that goes. But
but he always knew there was a great song coming up because he had that ability, and, you know, who knows what would have happened, you know, over the...
Oh, he'd have been huge. He'd have been just huge. I no doubt
Absolutely.
In my mind that was the case. And still so sad. And what I can understand, there were a lot of stories, and for people who hadn't heard, he and his wife Joanne were killed in a car crash after leaving a very interesting concert in Little Rock that was the first integrated concert, and a lot of riots and all that broke out. And some people were claiming that, well, it was racially being chased by people. But the reality, from what I know, is that it was Ray Charles's driver who Ray had fired him because he would do things like fall asleep, and that's who was driving when Jesse and Joanne were in the car, and that is why they didn't make it.
Well, do you want to hear another story that
yeah.
I'm not going to attribute it, but it was a person who was involved with Jesse.
Yeah.
He said that Jackie Wilson performed, I don't think it was a split audience where whites were on one side and blacks were on the other.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a white audience that saw the first show,
right,
and a black audience, or maybe it was the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
The black audience saw the first show, and the white audience saw the second show. But for whatever reason, the headliner was Jackie Wilson. Jackie Wilson deferred. He performed for the black audience. But there was some sort of problem when he was performing for the white audience, and he refused to do a complete show because of that problem, which enraged, you know, turned this into a racial problem. And that's why the white, you know, certain, you know, people in that particular audience took it out on Jesse and might have slashed his tires or messed with
right, and that was true. That was that 1968 Little Rock deal. That's absolutely true. And like you say, he played the first one, pulled out of the second one, and so that's one of the reasons that people thought that the death of Jesse Belvin and Joanne was related racially. But for everything I understand about that particular car crash, it wasn't. So
That person that told me the story has always had a grudge against Jackie Wilson because he said he somehow, by being stubborn in that regard, indirectly led to tragic results. And I don't know how fair or unfair that is. I've heard a few Jackie Wilson stories.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I better be talking about on the air, but there's some wild stuff.
Well, there were
in the business.
There absolutely were as far as that goes. But what a talent, you know. And when you're that talented, you get away with a lot. But what I did not realize about that Little Rock concert, because you know it was billed as the first integrated, but with the two shows, it wasn't integrated.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a white show and a black show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, well, and I don't know which came first.
The black show came first.
Okay, so Wilson did his
right.
complete show for the
he
black
did.
Audience.
And then he
and
pulled
the white
up.
Audience felt shortchanged, and there was
right.
a problem.
And, oh, man, they brandished guns and all that kind of stuff, chased him, you know, out of the parking lot and all that kind of stuff. But and I'm sure that's why people thought, oh, well, that's how Jesse Belvin wound up in that car accident, but it wasn't. So
wow.
very sad as far as that goes. And like I say, that driver was fired by Ray Charles, and supposedly what had happened was the car they were riding was a 59 Cadillac, blew a tire, and the driver, you know, reacted badly and obviously created the accident that killed them both.
You know, Billy Foster, who was married to Etta James at the time, you know, Billy Foster.
Sure.
Of the Medallions told me about a hair racing story where he was driving and there was a really bad accident. And I think there were a couple of deaths. And then Etta James, you know, this was in the South. When
yes.
She was on Argo or Cadet Records, narrowly escaped death in a very similar circumstance. So what does that say about the roads and
yeah, well, back then for sure. I think that they had left Memphis and they were heading south, probably through Mississippi when that happened.
Or to Muscle Shoals to record in Alabama.
Well, that'd have been great. Yeah, a little early for many people knowing about that, but yeah. And that's an interesting thing too. Rick Hall's studio down there. How many records were cut there? Of course, later in the Atlantic days, when Jerry Wexler went down there, a lot of people don't know this either. They actually the musicians left Rick Hall's studio and started another studio where most of that Atlantic stuff was cut. So it wasn't even the same studio.
Wow! No, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
It's you know, so much great activity in a short span of time in some of these places that it's just mind-boggling. Then it all goes away and we wonder what happened to it, you know? I mean,
well, that's what's so sad, and that's why, you know, bless you for writing the books that you have, because, of course, some of that stuff, you know, when we go, that's going to be the only record of any of it. So with that in mind, are you planning to write something else?
Yeah, I'm working on something, but it's the book that I'm trying to update my L.A. book, but...
Oh, yeah.
Man, how many pages, and I still have interviews, and I run into other people's interviews that are, you know, and also I'm doing a book on the history of rock and roll records throughout the 50s and 60s, and there were some really evil people in L.A. at the time that were, you know about Tony Alamo, don't you?
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what you want to... And we're talking about the guy who was the alleged evangelist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
uh-huh.
had children working at his... making his bejeweled vest.
Right.
Levi vest. Some of the activity he was involved in at the time, how he got people to record for him, and he had a couple of labels... And just was an operator for a couple of years in Hollywood, but I won't get into the really bizarre behavior. But
it was a twisted cult, to say the least. And Tony and Susan together, they were certainly the perfect couple. And I think that there was a book out about the children of Tony Alamo. So I've not read it. But Whispering in the Daylight was the title.
Well, he loved her so much he kept her on ice.
Yeah. So
he just liked having her around. So I run into characters like this. I think he's maybe the most extreme, but there were a lot. There was Richie Marsh, who became Sky Saxon.
Right.
And some of the stories he told me about, was it Bob Ross that recorded him? Bob Ross was willing to record Sky Saxon for free when he was Richie Marsh trying to be Elvis Presley, and in repayment of a free studio time, Richie had to dig a swimming pool for Bob Ross.
That's great. Of course, as Sky Saxon, he became the Seeds and pushing too
right.
hard. But that was interesting too, that wound up on Gene Norman's label. So I'm sure
right.
there's a story there too.
That was thanks to Jimmy Madden. You know Jimmy Madden, don't you?
Sure.
Yeah, who was a sort of a jazz vocalist who, when Tequila hit, he formed his own Champs and started touring because Danny Flores wasn't touring with the band at the time and did all sorts of California dates as the Champs. And later they recorded together, so, you know, I guess all was... you know, amicable in the end, but Jimmy had worked with Richie when Richie was struggling, and Sky, you know, became Sky and wanted the Vikings look. That's how he costumed the Saxons with Vikings helmets and fur jackets before Sonny Bono was doing that,
And
hit big with Pushing Too Hard, you know, the whole Sunset Strip anthem, the Sunset Strip days. So
oh, absolutely. And that one, to me, that was one of the worst records ever.
Rock and roll in
right.
action.
Okay. Right, yeah, just one of the worst. And it was, to me, the most surprising 1966 hit, but it was huge. We're talking with Steve Probst, and I can't wait to read that book, by the way. I want to be the first person to buy a copy because you know where all the bodies are buried. And, you know, the good news is, since none of them are alive anymore, as far as the label owners, you can tell all.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much the case.
Yeah.
You know, I can even talk about Johnny Otis or whoever.
I liked
but
him.
some people were really good people too. People like Dewey Terry of Don and Dewey.
Yep.
You know, I've got no complaints about him. He was just a pure soul. And Don Julian, no problem. Even right. Tony Allen, who came up with some bizarre stuff. You know, I think he was.
I liked
sweetheart.
Him. Yeah, I even liked him when he was in the Lions redoing some of his stuff. So I thought he was just great.
And I've got a trove of letters between him and Art Roop when he was writing Art Roop from San Quentin. Tony went to the Slammer because he had like a trunk full of marijuana between his commuting back and forth between Texas or Louisiana. And that'll do it every time. So, Tony learned the hard way. Don't be too much of a player.
Well, man, Art Roop, you could write an entire book about him. And and I'd really want to read that. We're talking with Steve Probst. And if you want to get in here, 888-876-5593. It's been the highlight of my day, that's for sure. And I can't wait to hear about every one of those label heads. But right now, I know if you listen to this show, you love radio, or else you wouldn't put up with me. So you probably know about the Sea Crane Company, ccradio.com. And you know that every radio that Bob Crane developed has one thing in common, just the best reception, AM and FM. So when I tell you he's got a Wi-Fi radio with great reception, I know that's like hitting Control, Alt, and Delete. What? Well, the deal is, if you have a wireless router or wireless access point, you know, depending on how hardy it is, some things connect easily, some things maybe not so much, or maybe if you want to put it in that back bedroom, not a prayer. Well, the beauty of the CC Wi-Fi 3 is it's going to connect to your wireless router no matter what. It's just great that way. So reception is there. But not only that, the audio is better than any smartphone in the world, and you can listen to just about anything you want with over 30,000 radio stations and even more in streams and all that. You won't run out of things to listen to. But what I really love about it is easy. And I say that because I put the first one down in front of John before a show, and I said, well, you figure it out. And he did, easily. And so the bottom line is it's intuitive. You don't have a big learning curve and all that kind of stuff. You don't sign up for an app. There's no microphone. There's no ads. ads on the screen, no monthly fee, and it's got a full-size remote control. Not to mention that superior reception. It sounds good. It is good. So go to ccradio.com, ccradio.com, and take a look at the CC Wi-Fi 3. I think you're going to be impressed. Now, if you can't go online, undoubtedly you don't want a Wi-Fi radio, but you might have someone in your life who you want to buy a wonderful present for. Well, call them. They've got the world's best customer service. They'll talk to you over the phone. You can order over the phone. Or if you want them to mail you a hard copy of the catalog, just ask. 800-522-8863. 800-522-TUNE. But if you can go online, oh man, the world is your oyster. CCRadio.com. Look at that CC Wi-Fi 3. You tell them Raleigh sent you from WGN Radio.
In your lifetime, there will always be a special someone who can make things happen that shouldn't happen, can make a dream a reality, make pain so much pleasure. Let me tell you about that someone in my life. My heavy load so much lighter. Who makes my darkest night so much brighter? No one but you, girl. When I'm in trouble, who comes when I call? Lay a head on my shoulder, say don't you worry at all. No one but you.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, speaking of Tony Allen. And we're talking to Steve Probst. And as I say, I'm just thinking more and more of that book. But with Tony Allen, of course, Night Owl is one of those heartbreaks, because to me, that record should have been a number one R&B record. And I think timing was the problem, because didn't they come out in 55, maybe around the time right before the Billboard was changing the charts?
No, what happened was that Night Owl was on specialty 560.
Uh-huh.
561 was a song called Tutti Frutti.
Oh, God.
And a label like Specialty can only work one hit at a time, so Night Owl got lost in the dust. But it became a standard. It became a lowrider standard. So it sold well throughout the decades, but it didn't, you know, hit the national charts because Little Richard was busy changing the face of rock and roll at the time.
Oh, man, that's interesting, because, yeah, it was 1955, absolutely. And
yep.
And the other thing, of course, is he had to spell it Night Owl, N-I-T-E. So if you've got it in your collection and you're looking for it and you're filing alphabetically, understand that it won't be N-I-G-H-T. I have
right.
lost that record for weeks at a time, not realizing. But,
well,
but yeah, and it was credited to Tony Allen and the Champs. So back to your Champ story.
That's right. He had the original Champs. They were the Champs when they backed Tony, and they were the Chimes when they were on their own. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that, because they also did a couple of records for Specialty as a group without Tony, including a song called Tears on My Pillow, having nothing to do with the Little Anthony
right.
song.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I saw that once. I thought, wow, I wonder if it's a remake. Yeah, exactly. So that's
yeah, totally different. I lost the train. Oh, yeah, talk about misfiling records. Some people would have fun with The Midnighters.
Oh. Well, you have to have two E's. And it's funny you say that, because I had a request that I'll play later, nothing like The Midnighters, but another The Prophets from Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Just put an extra E on it when there's another group of the same name. I can't believe the hour has gone by this fast, and I can tell you next time what we're going to talk about. I want to know more about these label owners. That's going to be terrific.
Oh, yeah, Eddie Davis.
You can't tell those stories.
You're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't even tell those stories. Yeah, I know. Breaks my heart. Yeah, poor Cannibal. Anyway, yeah, but the stories you can tell are just classic, and I can't wait to hear them. So thanks for taking time out.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk to you and revive what's left of our memories. You know, I struck out on Cicero Blake, but I'm going to do some research next time we talk. Maybe I'll have something for you on him.
Yeah, and Sounds of Dawn, the exact same record, different writer credits and all that. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait. And thank you, Steve.
Well, you're welcome. Good night.
All right, good night. Steve Probst, just the best. And, you know, I always give links to Amazon, but the books are just phenomenal. And, of course, what was the first rock and roll settler? Rock and roll record is an argument settler, or maybe it's an argument creator. I don't know, but it's a lot of fun to read, and I think you'll want to. So there you go. We'll pick it up next hour with whatever's on your mind and your requests, too, coming up on WGN Radio.